All right, is it on? Test, test. Last week we got all the way through, and Lisa said it didn't record. So, well, the only person that'll bother will be my mom. So she always listens afterwards. So anyway, we're continuing on today with the book of 2 John, or the second chapter of John, not 2 John, because that's a whole separate book. And then so Pat did all of chapter 1. You saw on the bulletin there, and then I've been working through chapter 2. We'll finish that today, and then starting next week, Sam will be working on chapter 3 for us, and then we'll continue to rotate through that. So great opportunity. I'm looking forward to that. So the one thing I just wanted to kind of reiterate real quick, the main themes that we've seen in the book of John, and you're going to see that continues throughout our discussion today. The main themes being a defense of the fact that Jesus is God. It started that way at the very first verse of chapter 1 of the book of John. And this theme that sinful man needs a redeemer. And that redeemer is Jesus. And if we turn to him, then we can be saved. And really, that is the theme that is woven all the way throughout the book of John. And we're going to see that continue today in the second chapter of John. And we're going to look at another series of events recorded by John once again as an eyewitness. So not as some distant story told that he'd heard in the past, but John is an eyewitness to the circumstances in the story that we're going to see today. So we're going to go first to John chapter 2, and we'll read verses 13 through 17, the first section of the section we'll go through today. So John chapter 2, verses 13 through 14, go to the next one, Lisa, says, "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers, and he overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, 'Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade.' His disciples remembered that it was written, 'Zeal for your house will consume me.'" So these are the first few verses that we're gonna go through, and so you know, here we are. We see that Jesus has come to Jerusalem. If you remember last week when we finished, we talked last week the story of Jesus when he turned wine into Cana, and in verse 12 of the second chapter, John said that after his disciples went down to Capernaum, after his time in Cana, he and his disciples went down to Capernaum with his mother and his brothers and his disciples, and they stayed there for a few days. And then we see the kickoff of verse 13 that we just read there, that with the Passover, the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And so what we're going to do today is we're going to start off with quite a bit of history I'm going to lay in here, because I think it's significant to this story, and it's important to what we're going to talk about in these verses that we talk about today. And so today we're going to talk a little bit about the Passover. So we start with John chapter 2, verse 13. "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem." So the Passover celebration goes all the way back to God's deliverance of the people of Israel from Egypt. And so if you can click on the next. So we're just going to go through a quick outline of what happened back then if you're unfamiliar with the story, or it's been a while since you've heard it. And it starts, if you remember, the people of Israel had come to the land of Egypt. And how that happened was that Joseph, in the land of Canaan, Joseph, one of the original brothers, so Joseph was sold into slavery, and he was sent to Egypt, and as a result of the slavery. And while he was there, Joseph became very powerful. Once again, God blessed him, and he became powerful, and he rose at one point to be the second most powerful in the entire land of Egypt. And so through a series of circumstances, his father and his entire household end up coming down to Egypt. And Joseph recognizes them, and even though his brothers sold him into slavery, Joseph recognizes them, and he brings them in, and he welcomes them in during a time of famine when his family was in need. And so, as a brief overline, so God had set up a circumstance, even though it was meant for poorness or meant for harm to Joseph. God took Joseph to Egypt, he established him there, and brought the rest of his family down to Egypt at a time of need. Over the course of time, the people of Israel grew, so Joseph and his family, from original about 70 that came down when Joseph's family came down originally, They grew to be approximately, experts believe, somewhere around 1 million people in the land of Egypt, in a place, special place in Egypt, one of the better places in Egypt, an area called Goshen. And over time, as pharaohs came and went, the pharaohs began to not trust the people of Israel. And the pharaoh that came into power at the time of the story we talk about today no longer had any remembrance or relationship with Joseph. And so the people of Israel were turned into slaves and slave labor for the people of Egypt. And the pharaoh had no interest in the people of Egypt, and he was actually concerned about them because of the vast number that they had, and he was concerned for security. And so at some point, God sends, the people of Israel were treated very harshly by the pharaoh, and so God sent Moses to help bring the people of Israel out of Egypt. And so Moses was going to be the spokesperson, if you will, or the person on the ground, but God was going to use his power, and it was going to be God's power that brought the people out of Egypt. And so we'll start here with Exodus chapter 5, verses 1 through 2. And it says, "After Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, 'This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go.' Pharaoh said, 'Who is this Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go.'" Well, that one thing is for very certain is that Pharaoh was right. He did not know the Lord. He had no personal relationship with God. And it's clear that Pharaoh was very adamantly opposed to letting the people of Israel go because they were a large labor force and it had a severe impact on the economy of Egypt. And then we're also going to see, though, in a verse here that God was very clear that God was going to make himself known to the Pharaoh and to the people of Egypt. And we see that in Exodus chapter 7, verse 5 here, where it says, "And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." So what would happen in the story, and I'm skimming through this just to lay the groundwork, is that God would send 10 plagues against the Pharaoh and the people of Egypt in order to make himself known. And the interesting thing about the plagues that God would send is that every plague God sent was a direct attack against gods with a little g, not real gods, but gods that the false gods that the Egyptians worshiped. So every plague that came against the Egyptians was targeted against one of their false gods. The final plague that was to come was going to be the death of the firstborn in all the households throughout Egypt, both human and animal. It was going to be a direct attack against the Pharaoh, who considered himself to be a god of Egypt, a man who considered himself to be a god. And so to those who believed in God, God was going to give very explicit guidance on how to avoid the final plague and God's final act of proof that he was the Lord. Should we go to the next slide? And so what happened is that God gave instructions to all the people of Israel, and really any Egyptian who would have turned to follow God could have followed the same set of instructions on what would happen and how they could avoid the final plague, which was going to be the death of the firstborn in every family. So if you think about that, think in your family, just in your household, how many people in your household might have been affected by the plague of the death of the firstborn? So in my family, I'm the firstborn in my family, so I would have died were I to have been alive there and rejected God. Brenna would have been the firstborn of my children. So just in our household of five people, two people would have passed. And so if you think through your household, I think the entire land of Egypt, all firstborn, both men and animals, were going to die. But God, as he always does, provides a deliverer and a way out. And so God's instructions to the people of Israel was to provide a substitute, right? So a common theme that we talk about throughout the Bible and that we'll continue to talk about. So God tells them, we're not going to go to each of these verses here, but God tells them in Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 and 3, that they were to take a lamb, so an innocent substitute, to die in their place. The lamb, in Exodus 12, 5, was to be a male without blemish. In verse 6, it tells us that they were to kill the lamb at the appointed time. God gave them instructions on when that lamb was to be killed, to be that sacrifice. And then they were to take the blood, according to verse 7 there, and they were to apply it to their over the top of their door. Then God gave them instructions in verse 22 that they were to stay inside their house that night until the morning. In verse 46, he gave him very instructions that the sacrifice, that no bones were to be broken in the sacrifice. And then in verses 12 through 13, and then in verse 28, you see here, God promised that he would pass over the households of all those who had followed his instructions. And so Exodus 12, verses 12 through 13 say, "On that same night I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn, both men and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." So, when God came in judgment against the Pharaoh, really, once again, this was a direct attack against the Pharaoh and his self-profession of being a god, that he would kill the firstborn in each household, but he would pass over every house where the blood was applied. As a result, God's chosen people were then freed and began their journey back to the land of Canaan, the promised land, a journey that would actually take them 40 years. But as a result of this story, and you'll see in the Old Testament that almost all the stories of deliverance in the Old Testament Jewish nation of Israel almost always referred back to the story of Egypt and the story of God's freeing the people of Israel from their captivity and their slavery in Egypt. Just like in the New Testament, almost all stories tie back to Jesus and his death and the freeing of us. So it's a significant story, and it ties back to Exodus 12:14, where God said, "This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance." So this Passover and this freeing of the people of Israel was to be a lasting celebration. And what we see in the Bible is that every year the people of Israel would celebrate the Passover. So that kind of brings up some questions on the Passover that are important for today. And so, you can go to the next slide, Lisa. And the celebration of the Passover, it was kind of interesting to do some research on this. And so it was really the question that I had, well, who participated in the Passover? And it turns out that every male over the age of 12, once they became an adult, every male then became responsible to journey to Jerusalem in order to fulfill the requirement for making a sacrifice in the temple. So if you remember some of the teaching we've talked about, that every year the head of household or an adult had to make a sacrifice. So an animal had to be shed, an innocent substitute, and their blood shed in order to pay the penalty, the death penalty, that each of us owe God as a result of our sin. So Jerusalem at the time, when the festival or the celebration of Passover came over, Jerusalem was a town of approximately 100 to 200,000 people. And so if you look at historical records, there's an indication that the city of Jerusalem would swell to somewhere between 1 million and maybe little over 2 million people during the course of the celebration of Passover. What we don't have is a really hard research or any firm evidence that what those numbers look like, but we do know that the population of Jerusalem would expand greatly as a result of the influx of people coming in to follow God's instructions in Exodus to commemorate the Passover. So remember, at this time, when Jesus was there, you know, the law was still in full effect, and every person, every male, had that responsibility to come and provide a sacrifice for the atonement and the covering of sin. So what would happen when people brought their sacrifices with them, when they came to Jerusalem, many of them lacked the transportation or the ability to bring a sacrifice with them. And so we saw that, you know, that list of instructions that we saw for Exodus, that it had to be a lamb, it had to be a male. All of those things continued on in God's instruction, his plans for the sacrificial system that was in place. So all of these things would end up tying into Jesus later on. So each family was responsible for bringing a sacrifice with them. If they were not able to bring it, then they would purchase it upon their arrival. And there was a few other things that were required of the people of Israel, and oftentimes they would choose the Passover time to fulfill those requirements. And so the one you see there, so every male over the age of 12 to the age of adulthood came to celebrate Passover. And then the activities that happened, the sacrifices for the temporary atonement of sin. And then each male over the age of 20
was required to pay a temple tax, which at the time was half a shekel, so which was the money that the Israelites used. So a half a shekel was the temple tax, and that tax that they paid every year was used to help maintain the temple. The other thing that would often be done at Passover or one of the other celebrations is that the family would bring their tithe or their giving to the church, and they would turn that over to the priests, and it would be disseminated via God's laws. So it's interesting, though. So these people would be coming, some in the area would be coming, would be from Jerusalem, but many would be coming from outside of Jerusalem. And so when they brought their money with them, oftentimes it was Roman coin, because Rome was the world power at the time. But others came from Africa or Egypt or other locations. And so they would bring coins or money that also, if it was Roman coins, it would have the picture of the Caesar. Potentially Egyptian coins, if they're brought, would have pictures of Egyptian gods. So that money, the non-Jewish money, was not acceptable for turning into the priests. And so what would happen, in addition to them having to buy sacrifices, that they would have to exchange their currency, if it was foreign currency, for the Jewish currency. And so that was just part of the process that the people of Israel would go through when they came to celebrate the Passover. So with all these people and all these requirements, you can imagine that it was a chaotic and it was a festival type of environment in Jerusalem. If you just think about it, there was three major celebrations that the Jewish people would celebrate each year, but the Passover was the biggest. And so if you can imagine, we think of different things that we celebrate here, and nothing really compares. Maybe the 4th of July, maybe New Year's in some places. But this huge celebration, this huge festival, all designed, all incorporated originally, right, to celebrate God and His redemptive power, God's pulling the people of Israel out of Egypt. What we're going to find, though, is that that things had changed. And then the last thing I want to talk about real briefly is the temple itself, because the temple is one of the central things in this theme here. So we're going to look at verse 14. Here's a picture of the temple, and this may be a little. Can anybody actually read any of the writing on there? Maybe if we got really good eyes. And it's the smaller words are not all that important, and so I'll talk about some of the key things here. So this is a drawing of what the temple would have looked like at Jesus' time. Obviously, the temple, it doesn't exist today, but the temple was God's dwelling place in a very special way with the people of Israel. Now remember, God is a spirit, so God is not limited to any particular area, but God chose, going all the way back to the people of Israel, as they left Egypt, He had them build a portable tabernacle, and it was a place where God had a very special presence for him. And at that time, as he led the people through the desert from Egypt back to the promised land, he would appear over that special place in the tabernacle as a pillar of fire at night and a pillar of cloud by day. And so when they moved back, when they finally got back into the land of Canaan and settled Israel, they built a temple. So Solomon built the first temple, which was later destroyed by the Babylonians. And then the Israelites at this time had built a second temple. And so the temple here had been in construction for about 46 years when this story occurs. And so after about 10 years, it was open for business when it first started construction. And so the actual temple itself was still, even 46 years later, was not completed. It was still in the process of being refined. And it wouldn't actually be completed until approximately 30 years later. So it was 63 A.D., that the temple was finally finished. Coincidentally, it went 46 years for construction there, add another 37 years, and then 7 years after it was completed in 70 AD, the Romans destroyed it and tore it to the ground. But some of the things that are important, I think, tie back to the story today is that when it was built, it had massive stones and a construction effort that was incredible. Experts today believe that And they have some of the stones there that some of the stones used to build the temple weighed in excess of 400 tons. This was a huge monument that you would expect to God. And it was an important place because remember, the tabernacle originally, now the temple, was the place of God's dwelling, his special dwelling place with the people of Israel. It was meant to be a place to commemorate the sacrificial system, right? And God's promise all the way back to Genesis 3:15 of a deliverer and a way for man to be reconciled to God. So although the temple was not completely functioning at this time, it covered a massive area. And the temple itself is this area. It shows up on this area here. And then there's some courtyards, all these things that King Herod put into place all around the temple now to just kind of set aside an area that was special and supposed to be sanctified for God. And you see these yards, these big courtyards here and here are called the Courtyard of the Gentiles. So the Courtyard of the Gentiles was a place within the temple grounds where anyone could go regardless of what nation they came from. So any Gentile, any person traveling to the city of Jerusalem could come into the court of the Gentiles. And then there were signs all along these entrances and some of the other courtyards that excluded non-Jews. And so the signs were put up in Greek and Aramaic, and they were very clear that anybody that was not a Jew, that was not a part of the nation of Israel, if they were to progress beyond the court of the Gentiles into the inner courts, closer to the actual temple itself, then the penalty was death. And interestingly enough, at the time, you know, Rome was in charge of Jerusalem, but the Romans allowed the Jewish people, the Israel nation, to enforce the death penalty if people violated this law and went into the inner courts. Even Roman citizens were subject to the death penalty, which is a fairly significant thing at the time. And so obviously it would have taken, they would have had some temple security, if you will, people who would enforce that. And it was strictly enforced if someone tried to move out of the court of Gentiles that was not authorized to do so. Then inside were some additional courts, but the only other one I'm going to mention is the court of the priests. And really this is where the sacrifices took place, right? So the priests were they were the go-betweens between people who would bring the animals and the sacrifices, and they would execute the sacrifices there inside in the court of priests. Now, the court of priests, it was only limited to, there was areas where Jewish men and women could come, but in the court of priests, it was only the priests that were allowed to go in there. There was entrances from each of the other courtyards, so it could be seen from a distance, and it was inside the court of priests that the great altar of burnt offering was. So all this kind of sets the stage. So you see that this entire large area, which experts believe was somewhere around 6 football fields, and a large, large festival-type area that would have been in place for the Passover. And so that kind of helps set the stage, I think, for the next verses as we look at and we talk about what Jesus sees. And so if we go to the next one, you see the outline there is that Jesus condemns the religious establishment. So John chapter 2, verse 14 says, "In the temple he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there." So now we just talked about the fact that there were some legitimate reasons for people to be exchanging money because they couldn't take Roman or other money, right? It had to be the Jewish money. So there was legitimate reasons for there to be money changers there. There was legitimate reasons for people to be selling cattle and lambs and sacrifices to people who were unable to bring their own, right? But what becomes evident through the rest of the story and Jesus' actions, along with historical research, is that the priests and the religious leaders of the day who controlled the temple were stealing from and ripping off the people of Israel. What happened was that the religion and the holy requirements of God were turned into a business and a profit center by the religious leaders. They were more interested in power and money than in helping God's people fulfill the requirements of the law. And so the very people, the priests, that God had tasked with to look out for his people and assist his people were taking advantage of them. So what would happen is that someone would come up if they did bring a sacrifice, and the priest would look at it and say, oh, your lamb doesn't meet the requirement because it has a flaw. And so that your sacrifice is not going to be acceptable, but you can purchase one from us. And then they would jack the rates up, and they would take advantage of the people that came. And this happened over and over and over again. The other thing that they would do, the money changers, is that when they would come, you know, throughout the rest of the year, you could exchange money for a rate. But what would happen during the Passover time, and inside these the temple grounds and in these big areas, the money changers were inflating their exchange rates significantly, almost 20 times more than what it would have been in another time. So they were taking advantage of these people who had to come in and participate in the Passover. So they were disqualifying their sacrifices. They were ripping them off at the exchange rate. All these things done at the hand of the priests who were making a profit out of everything that was happening inside the temple grounds. So here was the celebration that was supposed to focus on God and His deliverance, and it was being twisted by those in charge. So it was supposed to be a chance for the people to reconcile to God. It was supposed to be a celebration of the fact that God had provided a way for man to be reconciled and our relationship to be repaired. And what happened is the priests were using it, the circus-type atmosphere, to maximize the experience and the power that that they had. So ultimately what it became was not about God, and it became about man at the hands of the priests. And so Jesus, it's interesting, sometimes I read stories about Jesus, and you know, Jesus is is often portrayed as a meek, turn-the-cheek, other kind of guy, that Jesus would just get along to get along. And really, if you read the Bible, you find out that that's not really accurate. That's not an accurate portrayal of who Jesus was. Jesus was very loving, but he was a very strong-willed. And so what we see that Jesus comes in, and he is angered and upset about what he sees happening in the temples. And so if we go to if you get the next one, Lisa, John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. And it says, "And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, 'Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade.' His disciples remembered that it was written, 'Zeal for your house will consume me.'" So kind of interesting, right off the first there. So Jesus made a whip of cords, and he drove them all out of the temple. So so basically what he did is he took, they would have a bunch of animals there, and they would have cords and leads. So he put them together, and he went around, and he just used this like a scourge, and used it to beat these guys and to push them out of the temple. So it's kind of a fascinating thing to think about this, because remember I just talked about the fact that to go outside of the courtyard of the Gentiles, to go inside, there were these temple guards. So what's fascinating to, if you read this, and it's almost easy to miss, to just go right by it, that here's one man who comes in, and he begins to cleanse the temple of all these things. This huge, massive area of all these people selling sacrifices, all these money changers, and Jesus forms this whip of cords, and he begins to drive them all out of the temple. He flips over their tables, he pours out their coins, and he tells them to take these things away and to not make his Father's house a house of trade. Now, to this point, we in our timeline, we talked timeline last week, so we're maybe a couple, maybe 3 weeks into Jesus's ministry. So he transitioned his first 30 years of life. We don't hear a lot about him. So this is maybe 3 weeks into his 3 years. So his first miracle was performed maybe just a week ago in Cana at the wedding. And we talked last week how, even though it was a miracle, he changed water into wine. It was very low-key. Not many people knew what happened. The servants who brought in the water and he changed it, they knew what happened. His disciples, but no one else really at the wedding doesn't appear to know what happened. But now here's this unknown guy, and he walks in. He makes this whip, and he's going through, and he's cleaning out the temple. This is a big deal, and there's no indication that even if the temple guards came, there's no indication that anything was done to stop Jesus. Somehow, he had an authority, and obviously we know that it's because of that he was God. But from this unknown man of 30 years of time, Now Jesus is well known, right? He has come in and he has called out the religious leaders of the day. Because you know that the priests absolutely knew what was happening. They knew that the people of Israel were being ripped off. And they were part of it, right? They were enriching themselves through all the activities that were happening. So now Jesus comes in, and what he really demonstrates here is his power. And it is a real miracle, not in the obvious way that we think of it, but just the fact that he was able to do this proves his deity, and he's demonstrating, once again, his power. So Jesus exposed the religious leaders of the day in a big way. And it was an interesting way for him to start, really, his official ministry. And he made many enemies, but also we'll see that many people came to believe as a result of his actions. So there's a couple other things here that I want to point out that are significant in these verses. So in verse 16, we see that Jesus tells the seller of the pigeons to not make his father's house a house of trade. So even this small phrase has some power that we might miss if we don't understand the wording. It's significant because Jesus is claiming a special status here when he says, my father's house. So Jesus is claiming the equivalent of being God. Now we know that's to be true, right? But here's this unknown guy. He comes in, he's flipping tables, he's throwing these things out, he's driving people out with this whip, and then he claims to be God. And so the terminology that he uses here, any place else in Israel, and we see it happen in a couple other places in the Bible, this terminology would normally result in someone being stoned for blasphemy, for claiming to be God. But here is this unknown Jew, he's coming through, he's cleaning God's house and his temple, and he's claiming to be God while he does it. In verse 17, so we see his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. And so his disciples, as this was happening, they recall Psalm 69:9, where that phrase shows up in the Old Testament, that zeal for your house will consume me. So the interesting thing, you know, the book of Psalms was written about 1,500 years before Jesus' time. And so what we see here is a very clear prophecy that at some point Jesus would come in, and Jesus' zeal, that he would have a zeal for his father's house. And in doing so, Jesus begins to fulfill Old Testament prophecy of what would happen in Jesus' ministry. Jesus would not condone the lack of reverence for God that was happening outside the temple in what was supposed to be one of the greatest celebrations of God's deliverance for the people of Israel. But the interesting thing is this: the phrase consume me stood out to me because Jesus, so he's 30 years old at this point in time in his life. He'd been coming to the temple every year since he was 12. So over time, Jesus had seen, and we don't know the details, so maybe during the time since he'd been 12, it'd gotten worse and worse. But we know that over time, this would have been something that bothered him every single year when he went. So, but this year, his zeal for God consumed him, and Jesus took action. And in fact, we're going to see that it's not just in Psalms that Jesus has prophesied that this would happen, but we're going to see this in the book of Malachi. And so we're going to turn to Malachi chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. In Malachi chapter 3, verses 1 through 4 says, behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord, whom you seek, will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant... Excuse me. All right, I'm going to start over again. Behold, I send my messenger, and he will prepare the way before me. And the Lord, whom you seek, will suddenly come to his temple. And the messenger of the covenant, in whom you delight, behold, he is coming, says the Lord of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming, and who can stand when he appears? For he is like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. He will sit as a refiner and purifier of silver, and he will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver. And they will bring offerings in righteousness to the Lord. And then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to the Lord as in the days of old, as in the former years. And so these verses very clearly tie back to what Jesus saw when he came to his temple. So Jesus is a refiner. Jesus is coming to purify the people of Israel in a way that they don't even understand. Even his disciples, who are now just beginning to get a picture, an image of who Jesus is, they don't understand this yet. But the prophet Malachi talked about this, that in the day of his coming, who can stand when he appears? And we can see that right there, that when Jesus pushed the sellers and the frauds out of the temple grounds, the religious leaders had clearly lost their perspective on God. But Jesus was going to change all of that in the coming days. When he drove the people out of the temple, it was a clear display of his deity and his special status. And you can imagine that the religious leaders had to have been stunned and unable to adequately explain or control what was happening outside that temple. There is historical evidence that oftentimes, or other times throughout history, through Josephus, who was a Roman historian, that other times when there were protests and other things outside the temple, that there were times when the temple guards actually killed people and large groups of people as part of protests. And so this is a clear display of Jesus and his deity and his power. This man who came in and claimed a special status as God, he was wrecking all the carefully laid plans of these religious leaders. And worst of all, he was exposing their sin before all the people in the temple and all the Gentiles. Remember, the religious leaders, and we'll see this throughout the New Testament, the religious leaders had this, I mean, they really believed that they were righteous, right? That they had earned God's, or earned a good standing with God. So the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the high priests, all these religious leaders believed that they were the keepers of the law and that they were the examples and the witnesses for all the other people. And here Jesus comes in, he's kicking them out, and he's exposing their fraud to all these people, to include the Gentiles. It was a major undertaking that Jesus takes when he cleans the temple out. And now it was fully in the public eye. The religious establishment had received notice from Jesus. Now, the other thing I want to point out here is that even though all these things were happening, that it maybe gives the appearance that Jesus was a man out of control, right? That he had just flipped and that he was that he'd gone off. But that's not the Jesus of the Bible, and that's not really the picture that we got here. Jesus was absolutely in control throughout this entire display. So there's no indication that any person is hurt or things there, but Jesus was angry, and he was making a display, and he was giving notice to the religious leaders of the day, and he did so absolutely in control throughout his entire life, from 1,500 years ago in Psalm, and about 800 years before that in Malachi. Jesus knew exactly what was going to happen, and he'd been preparing for this all along. So we see all this happening. We see the lead up in Psalms and Malachi. Jesus was in complete control, and he's going to begin the process of refining the people of Israel that we saw in Malachi, right? So refining is to take something that's impure and to make it pure. So how is this going to happen? Jesus is going to explain that in verses 18 through 22. So let's go to John chapter 2, verses 18 through 22. So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" And Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And then the Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. So once again, we see some significant things here. Remember, I just talked about the temple, and it's some of the stones, just this magnificent building that had taken, they believe, somewhere 15,000 to 30,000 laborers were involved in the building of the temple, 46 years up to this point. And Jesus says, because they ask for a sign. So here Jesus has done this really incredible miracle. He's cleared out all these vendors. He's cleared out all these people, taking advantage of the people of Israel. And the response that he gets back is, "Well, give us a sign that you are who you say you are." So he's already performed a miracle right in front of them, and then they ask for this sign. He says, "Well, tear this temple down, and I will rebuild it in 3 days. And so they're looking at the grounds and these huge, massive stones, and their challenge is, well, it's taken 46 years. How could you possibly rebuild it in 3 days? And obviously Jesus was talking about the fact that he was through his refining process, that he was going to be the refining process for the people of Israel, and that he would die, and that 3 days later he would rise from the dead. And it says here that his disciples, once they recognized that, his disciples remembered what he had said, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. You know, so many times his disciples, he's teaching them for 3 years. Now this is early on, right? So this is they've really been Jesus' disciple for maybe 3-4 weeks at this point. But even at the end of his time, he would share these things, words with his disciples, and they wouldn't understand them. And then when he died, it all became clear to them. You know, the word of God became true, or it's true before, but they could understand it. And so it wasn't until later on that they recognized the very words that Jesus had said. So Jesus was going to refine the people of Israel, yet in a special way that none of them, even the disciples, could understand. And it would happen just as the original Passover happened. And we see some of the parallels here. The words are kind of smaller, but they would take a lamb. Remember, that was the first requirement for in Exodus for the Passover to happen. And remember in John chapter 1, where John the Baptist sees Jesus coming, and his response was, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." So Jesus would be that lamb. He would be a male without blemish, perfect in every way, without sin. They would kill the lamb at the appointed time, which is a story for later. His blood, the blood of the lamb in Exodus would be applied to the doorstops. Jesus' blood for us would be applied to the cross. And then as a result of those, do not break any of the bones. If you're familiar with the crucifixion story of Jesus, that even though he was crucified, that none of his bones were broken. And the normal process for someone being crucified after a period of time in order to finish them off more quickly would be to break their legs so that they could no longer push up on the cross to breathe, and they would end up suffocating to death. But because of the circumstances of Jesus, that was not how he was killed on the cross, that a sword was pierced his side, and so a sword was used to kill him. So all these things that we see from the Exodus are replayed in the story of Jesus and his death and his refinement, his reaching out to people. And so refining is a very difficult process, be it with metals or with people, right? It is the process of the first step in the process of refining is to identify the impurities. So if you're refining metals, you want to identify what impurities, what other impurities are within the metal that you're refining. If you're refining people, the key part of that is to identify the impurities within us, right? The sins that keep us separated from God, that keep us impure. So in metalwork, the process of heating and removing the impurities is the hardest and the hottest work that happens. And with people, it is much that same way. After all, who of us is not like the religious leaders of Jesus' day? So who of us doesn't like it when someone points out our sin, when someone points out the way that we are maybe treating people poorly? We don't like being exposed for who we are oftentimes, and certainly that was the case for the people, the religious leaders of the day, and many, many people throughout Jesus' lifetime and his ministry, when he would identify their need for him and their sins, and people would reject that. Because the refining process is difficult. But it isn't until the impurities are cleansed, right, that you have the beautiful gold, the beautiful jewelry, and it isn't until the impurities are taken out of us that we have the opportunity for righteousness, right, for that perfection that God requires of us to have that relationship restored. And Jesus is the refiner, and we saw that all the way back to Malachi. We see that throughout the story. And Jesus was putting the people of Israel and the religious leaders on notice that he was there and he was the refiner, he was God. And really, this refining process is a picture of what Jesus did. And I ran across a quote from John MacArthur. that said, "Love comes after Christ shatters our complacency of sin." I'll read it one more time. "Love comes after Christ shatters our complacency of sin." And I thought, wow, that is such a picture of what Jesus was doing in the temple, right? As he shattered their complacency about taking advantage of people and making what should have been a tremendous celebration of God's redemption of the people of Israel and the coming, Jesus' coming redemption of all people, they were challenging God, and Jesus was really putting himself in a position to shatter their complacency. And it's really the story of the Bible, that God wants us to recognize our impurities. He wants to shatter our complacency of sin, not in order to teach us a lesson, but in order to draw us back to him and that relationship with him, so that we can be refined and that we can spend an eternity with him. Jesus can't offer his love until sin in our lives is resolved, right? Until we've recognized our need for Christ, until the Lamb of God has fulfilled his purpose in our lives, until we have believed upon Jesus Christ. And we can't accept Jesus' love until we recognize our own personal need. And that's the entire process of refinement that Jesus brings with him. And so we see a tremendous story here that if you read through it quickly, you maybe miss some of the key aspects of what happened. So it wasn't just Jesus freaking out and throwing all these people out of the temple. This was a miracle, and this was setting the stage for Jesus to come in and establish his ministry and begin the very beginnings of the church and the beginning of the process that would lead up to, 3 years later, his death on the cross as the Lamb of God and his refining, putting in one place, one time, for all men, the ability for us to rely upon him for a sacrifice. So with that, ask the worship team to come up. And I would just ask you to reflect on that story this week and just think about that. And if you've not taken that time to turn your life over to God, if you've never been through that refining process, then ask me about that afterwards, and we can talk some more. So, thank you.